Before we begin this podcast, I'd like to tell you about a special deal. Subscribe today to The Spectator for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with, here's the magic bit, a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Lara Pendergast, The Spectator's executive editor. On this week's podcast, we look into Reform's plan for power, we explore what happens when a person goes missing, and we discuss whether 007 can be saved.
I am now leading, and in historical terms, this is incredible, I am now leading Reform UK, and we are now topping every opinion poll in Britain. And we are going to win the next general election and save our country. We're going to do it. We're going to do it.
That was Reform UK's leader Nigel Farage addressing America's CPAC conference last week. In the general election last year, Reform won just 14% of the vote, but now they consistently lead in the opinion polls as we get ever closer to May's local elections. As the newest force in British politics, little is known about the team behind Farage. Well, Katie Balls and James Keel write the cover piece for this week's magazine in which they ask who's who in Nigel's gang. They look at the various groups that make up the inner circle of the party, and they also look at Reform's plans as they plot for the next general election. Katie and James join the podcast to discuss more, and I started by asking them to take us through Reform's journey so far.
Ultimately, have Nigel Farage come up back at the last minute during the general election, then a campaign put together quite haphazardly and five MPs elected, which was probably higher than many expected. I think that they think it could have been even higher had they had not had problems with the vetting of candidates. There are various stories about, you know, he was standing for Reform and past embarrassing comments and so forth. Since then, there's been a big effort to try and professionalise the operation. So you have Zia Yusuf, who they've effectively outsourced the running of the party to, a former businessman who sold his company for a lot of money. He now works for free, as one figure said to me for the piece. He could be on a beach chilling. He's decided to instead work 16-hour shifts for free. And you have seen, I think, in this period whereby the Labour government has really struggled in its first 100 days, the Tories are trying to get their act together, but they still have all the baggage of being the incumbents and being in government for over a decade. Reform have found an opportunity to really have their voice heard by being pretty agile. A lot of the work is not done really in the House of Commons. It's quite hard as a small group to do. Instead, various rallies around the country. They have this new shiny office we talk about in Milbank Tower, a sense that you've had different iterations in the past of Nigel Farage, you know, as a political force and a party, UKIP, the Brexit party. This one is a mix of Farage old timers, conservatives who are defecting to a degree, and then actually these Gen Z men who are almost making Nigel Farage digital and modern in a way that was perhaps lacking in the past. And all those efforts now see a situation where, more than not at the moment, you see Reform leading in the polls ahead of Labour and the Tories, only by a couple of points. But that is a real shift, if you think about to where they were a year and a half ago.
James, obviously the next election is a few years away, but did you get the sense when you were looking into this that Reform seem to have a coherent plan for how they're going to approach the next few years?
Well, I think currently it's about making them a proper campaigning outfit. The sense perhaps of some of Nigel Farage's parties is that they were great on the air war, less good at the ground game. And that's why I think the potential upcoming Runcorn by-election in Cheshire is going to be so interesting to see, because you'd think, given the current mood, Reform have a good chance of taking that. The key thing, of course, is training up the activists. And that's going to be the key focus over the next 2 years or so. They really have these regional organisers coming in into the office once a month. There are 11 of them based on the old European constituencies, which were fought by UKIP and the Brexit Party. And that's a different model. I think that's the interesting thing between them and the Tories, for instance, which the Tories have stuck with this Victorian model of associations and running politics in an old-fashioned way, I'd say, compared to Reform, which has a very different sort of pop-up party model. And so as that, they are going to be looking at campaigning, making sure that their campaigners and candidates are aware of electoral law, are best placed to sort of make arguments on the doorstep. And then further down the line, as we get closer to 2029, Lara, I think you'll see more of the policy. There are discussions about a think tank potentially being launched. They want to try and get a better approach to policy in a manifesto that's not going to come under scrutiny in a campaign. But right now, it's really about amassing the forces and having, as Katie says in the piece, this sort of contradiction in some ways between this people's army, the many 215,000 members, the last count, across the country, while also having quite a sort of small, tight clique around Farage, which is able to be quite nimble and avoid some of the problems that the bigger, older parties might face.
And just following on from what Katie said about the Gen Z tribe, could you talk a little bit about who they are and the role that they're playing in kind of making Farage appeal to a younger audience?
Absolutely. So Nigel Farage, in some ways, is both old-time success and quite a modern story. He, by dint of his longevity, has had more experience as a leader than both Kemi Badenoch and Keir Starmer have had as MPs. So that longevity can be a great asset to him. Right from the early days of the UKIP's first bid onto the national scene in sort of 2008, when he went viral for mocking Herman Van Rompuy and the European Parliament, he's amassed a significant social media presence. And now that is being sort of handed over and run by very capable, very digitally savvy young people in the press team. And we pick up two of them, for instance. One of them is Jack Anderton, who dresses all in black and is teetotal and is a very distinctive presence in the office. I'm not sure how many teetotalers Nigel Farage's various outfits have ever had, but he's certainly one of the most notable and most current ones. And then there's also Charles Carlson, who is the nephew of Tucker Carlson, the American political commentator. He very much, I think, is someone who is a new arrival and is trying to sort of appeal to a couple of things that Reform are keen to talk about, which is one of which the American links and also Gen Z as well. And so the key challenge, of course, Lara, is, you know, they want to get professionalism and professionalized very much in the mantra. That's the word you hear constantly talking to them, is professionalization, while also keeping that element of fun. And sometimes the fun side, the perhaps the old amateurism will come to the fore, and other times it'll be more sort of ruthless professionalism. But getting that right is key, and that's why Gen Z and appealing to young people on the different platforms is going to be a key part of Reform's messaging over the next 3 years or so.
Katie, who's more worried about Reform's rise, Labour or the Tories? And perhaps who should be more worried?
I think it depends on your time limits. I think that in the immediate, it's more worrying for the Tories because it makes Kemi Badenoch's leadership of the party harder. And the Tories look at the polls. And there was one poll yesterday where the Tories were 1 point ahead of both Labour and the Conservatives, which I showed to Robert Jenrick because we're doing Coffee House Shots Live in the green room. And he seemed pleased with that. But of course, that is not the average. And I think that therefore, what Reform doing well right now does to the Tory party is it gets in all the Tory MPs' heads. It makes them think. You have MPs on the right saying, oh, we have to do some type of pact. That makes it hard for Kemi Badenoch not to have her own space to do the slow rebuilding she wants to do. And it puts pressure on things like the local elections and so forth. I think for Keir Starmer, Reform is a headache. And when you speak to figures in Labour saying, so how worried are you about the opposition? They will often respond just talking about Reform as opposed to talking about the Tory party, which shows you how things have shifted. And certainly, I think in number 10, particularly under Morgan McSweeney as chief of staff, there is you're looking at blue Labour. They're looking at, the reports this week that Muneera Mirza, who advised Boris Johnson, is talking about multiculturalism and integration with Labour. And you do get a sense that they're trying to respond to the offering. And I think when you speak to senior figures in the Labour Party, it is not so much that they think their voters have gone to Reform yet. I don't think they're terrified by the current numbers per se, but they want to stop their voters going there in the future. And that's what a lot of this is about. So that's a longer term challenge to get to. So problems all round, just depends what day it is.
Just to add on Katie's point, I think right now Labour are currently auditioning different types of ideology. That was a word that was used to me earlier today by someone in Labour, auditioning different types of creed, hence why they're entertaining currently the Blue Labour faction. They're talking about Muneera Mirza. And I think it's seeing what works. And that's what we say in this piece is that nimbleness and the adaptability are the key things. And, you know, in a digital age, analog parties might get brushed aside. And that's what I think Reform are trying to do right now, which is why they're having things like Archie Manners, the celebrity magician coming in as a consultant, trying different ideas. Some of those will be crazy ideas. Other ones will be slightly fun. I mean, just last week we saw Reform UK spinners were going around the parliamentary lobby, handing out to journalists books titled Kemi Badenoch's Successes First 100 Days. And the whole book was completely empty. Mm-hmm. And that sort of sense of fun is what they're trying to get across while conveying a serious message as well.
And as well as voters moving over to Reform, are there any politicians that perhaps we should keep an eye upon? Are there any rumours of this? I mean, the big defection, obviously, was Lee Anderson last year, but also more recently, former MP and Tory MP Andrea Jenkins, now the Reform candidate for mayor in Greater Lincolnshire. Can we expect more in the future, do you think?
I think potentially, and certainly, you know, one thing's in the piece is the sense that, you know, so many Tories trying to come over now, they sigh, they're just, you know, delusional. But also there's a question of, will there be a big defection? That's one of the rumours, that they might have a former cabinet minister defection coming up. I think that the one that probably is one, which I don't think will necessarily happen, but the one that people talk about is, of course, Suella Braverman, because her husband has already defected to Reform. Now, of course, Suella Braverman is very capable of having different views on her husband. But you look at where she stood on issues as Home Secretary, but also in the party. And I think her politics do align quite closely with lots of the things that Reform do. Now, lots of people say, oh, Liz Truss, she could join Reform. Well, that's actually less of a straight fit in my view, whereas I think Suella Braverman and lots of things she wants to focus on do match. And therefore, could she be tempted at some point? She hasn't completely ruled it out. And that would be, you know, a seismic moment. You also have Robert Jenrick, who is seen as someone who, you know, I think if you, sometimes you can look at things, not saying you need this all the time, through the access of Dominic Cummings' Twitter account. And if you decide to do that, you will notice that Robert Jenrick is often retweeted approvingly by Dominic Cummings. Dominic Cummings also writes on his Substack about Reform, the need for regime change. Dominic Cummings and Nigel Farage have clashed much in the past, but there seems to be, when you're talking about the need for regime change, Reform and Robert Jenrick, there just feels there's a little bit more overlap, if that makes sense. I don't think that's about Robert Jenrick joining the Reform Party, but it does point to the question that if Kemi Badenoch was not leader at some point in the future, say, you know, years away, I think Robert Jenrick is seen as someone in Reform that they might be find it easier to do a deal with or some type of pact than Kemi Badenoch. Of course, I prepare for everyone to message me saying we're not doing a pact on all sides, but these are the conversations being whispered.
And James, just finally, who are Reform looking to for inspiration politically, perhaps kind of across the globe? Is it Trump and the MAGA movement, or are there other political groups that they take inspiration from?
I think that they are obviously inspired by the success of the MAGA movement in America, and the UK as a country is the most obviously culturally downstream from America. I think they're fairly, shall we say, promiscuous in their ability to you know, look around and take what works. I mean, I asked Nigel Farage at the press conference in September, I said, you know, are you taking inspiration from other parties across Europe? And he sort of batted away the question and made the point about first past the post being a different system to many of the continental ones. But I do think that it's an interesting question. I think the obvious Canada is the example, which is that Canada 1993, the Reform Party there destroyed the Canadian Progressive Conservative Party and then went on to then sort of take over the Progressive Conservative Party and become the modern Conservative Party of Canada. That is something that Nigel Farage has talked a lot about. Preston Manning was the inspiration for that. But in terms of, you know, sister parties, etc., I think Reform are rightly a little bit wary and sceptical. And you see this is partly Farage's own political memory, which is that, you know, he was someone who was trying to form groups in the European Parliament. He was dealing with Le Pen's party. He was dealing with sort of the forerunners to AFD. And I think they're wary, perhaps, having seen what happened with Elon Musk and Musk then turn on Farage, of getting too involved in entanglements elsewhere, because I think they're very aware that they want to have their own British distinct version of Reform. And that while you can learn lessons and successes from different continental parties, you know, insurgent parties on the right challenging the incumbent parties, you look at, for instance, the Gaullists collapsing in France, I think that that goes up and up to a point. So they'll take inspiration from anyone everywhere, but I think that you know, Farage will claim that he's his own man in all this.
James and Katie, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Laura, what else did you enjoy from the magazine this week?
Judy Bevan's written a piece about the struggle that she and her husband had when they were trying to adopt. They were specifically told that they had too many books, essentially that they were too middle class. And she's looking at why some social workers seem to sort of have this belief that children should only be matched with people who are very close to their own social class or ethnic background. She says this might just about be understandable were it not for the case that so many children in Britain are in care and presumably would want to be adopted. So I'd recommend that. What about you, Will? What did you enjoy?
I really love the Notes On feature this week, which is by Canon Dr. Francis Young, the historian and folklorist. And he's written a, I think, wonderful Notes On Shrove Tuesday. And what's wonderful about it is he uncovers perhaps a rather cruel side to the history of Shrove Tuesday. And he has recorded a out loud version of his article, so we can hear that now.
In some countries, Shrove Tuesday, the day of merrymaking before the rigours of Lent, developed into a carnival that lasted several days. But in England, it was only ever a half-day holiday, since it was not an official church feast day. Apprentices and schoolchildren claimed the right to an afternoon of sport, and from at least the 15th century, the most popular Shrove Tuesday recreation was throwing at cocks. This was a cruel custom that involved immobilising a cockerel, either by tying its foot to a stake or half-burying it in the ground, while bystanders took turns throwing stones, tools and bricks at the cockerel in an attempt to kill it. The successful killer received the dead bird as a prize, which might account for the custom, since Shrove Tuesday was traditionally the last day before Easter when flesh could be consumed. Sometimes referred to as cock threshing or holling at cocks, the custom varied throughout the country, but invariably ended with the fowl's demise. This throwing at cocks was just one of many English blood sports in an era of casual cruelty to animals, but it stands apart from others, such as bear baiting, cock fighting, and dog fighting, because it was the first to attract moral objections. As early as the 1730s, letters appeared in newspapers deploring the custom, not so much on the grounds of its intrinsic cruelty, but for its lack of sportsmanship. After all, the tethered or buried cockerel had no chance to defend itself, and the contest was not one of equals like a cockfight.
Next, is technology a help or a hinder when it comes to missing people? Most of us might assume that having a smartphone has made it easier to get help if we go missing, for example, when hiking. But what happens when someone thinks you're missing when you're not? That's what Ross Clark writes about in the magazine this week. Ross was hiking in Scotland late into the evening when his phone broke, and his wife understandably assumed that Ross was missing. Ross writes about what he learned from being a missing person for a few hours. Ross joined us alongside the journalist and political correspondent for GB News, Catherine Forster. Catherine's own sons, who use smartphones to track a hiking route, did go missing last year in Bali. Their phones died and they were unable to contact anyone. So in their case, did technology help or hinder them? I started by asking Ross to take us through his own experience.
Well, I'd had a fantastic day out on the hills climbing off Glen Shiel in the Western Highlands. Fantastic day. It's quite icy, but I survived. I went back to the holiday cottage where I was staying, had some supper and went to bed. The only casualty of the day had been my phone, which meant I wasn't able to message my wife as I would normally do, say I was back safely. And I did email her from my laptop, but evidently she hadn't read that. And about midnight, I heard this phone ringing. The phone could ring, but I couldn't answer it. So, you know, it was quite obvious that this was my wife trying to get hold of me, desperately worried that I'd gone missing in the wintry conditions. And so I thought, well, what do I do now? I looked on the map. The nearest telephone box was half an hour's drive away, and that was marked on a map that's 10 years old, so probably isn't there anymore. I tried to find some way of texting my wife from my laptop, but I couldn't do that. And anyway, eventually it dawned on me that, you know, my wife would almost certainly have reported me missing to the police, and she had indeed done that. So a copper was dispatched to our home back in Cambridgeshire, and he turned up, demanded to go all through our WhatsApp messages and wanted to go on my computers, wanted to go through my bank accounts and everything. Extraordinary, the sort of level of investigative detail he wanted to go into it. There seems to be sort of one standard system for investigating missing persons, which is perhaps more suited to 15-year-old girls who've gone run off with their boyfriends or bankrupt businessmen who are trying to fake their own death and so on. So, you know, hence the going through my bank accounts and trying to see if I'd spent any money, which was absolutely physically impossible where I was staying out on the Glen Eld Peninsula, because one shop that closes at 5 p.m. and one pub which opens Thursday to Sunday. So, yeah, for 3 hours I was officially a Lord Lucan, a missing person, and I managed to sort of shut it off eventually by emailing Police Scotland, and they did warn it wasn't a, you know, emergency service, not something you're supposed to do in an emergency. It might take 24 hours to get back to me, but they did in fact read the email within an hour, and then they knew I was okay, but they still insisted on sending a cop around to the holiday place where I was staying just to check I hadn't been murdered and somebody was impersonating me. So just an interesting experience, but it also sort of rather sort of brings to light sort of how society's changed, because, you know, 40 years ago when I was 18, I went off interrailing for a month. I probably told my parents vaguely where I was going, but I still certainly didn't leave them with a detailed plan because I didn't have a detailed plan of where I was going myself. And, you know, they didn't seem to worry about it. Nobody seemed to worry in those days. But now you sort of fail to keep in contact with people for a few hours and you get the full Lord Lucan treatment. It's that sort of mobile phones, well, obviously being terribly useful in many ways, and I'm sure they've saved many lives, but they've also created this expectation that we will be constantly in touch, and that's not always possible.
Catherine, you have quite an extraordinary experience in which your sons actually did go missing last year. I wonder if you could briefly explain your experience for our listeners.
Yes, well, my two sons, who were 22 and 19 at the time, in their infinite wisdom, decided to hike up a 3,000-metre volcano in Bali in the middle of the night to see the sunrise. I didn't know anything about it until they'd been missing for 30 hours. But they had taken with them a phone, one bottle of water, no food, no compass, no map, and a dead power bank. They'd followed an app that had told them it was a 7-hour round trip, but it was actually the route on the app was sort of disused. So they struggled. They got to the top of the volcano. They thought they'd meet a guided group. There was just a very sheer precipice and cloud. They couldn't find the way back down. So they were incredibly stupid in that they had relied on tech, not properly prepared. You know, they didn't even have two fully charged phones. The power bank was dead and so on and so forth. But having said that, tech also saved them, because what happened is on the way up, my son had taken screenshots of the route on an app. He'd sent it to a girl that he'd met in Vietnam. And when they were out of contact with that girl after about a day and a half, she realised something was wrong and she reported them to the Foreign Office. And then the following morning, she tried to get hold of me on Instagram. I don't look at my Instagram messages because I don't communicate that way. The following morning, I tried to phone them because it was the day of the general election. I wanted to see how I was going to vote for them and I couldn't get them. But when they didn't come back quite quickly, I started to be a bit worried. And then I used the Find My app on an iPhone to see where Matthew, my eldest, had last been. And it showed his location 2 days prior at the top of a 3,000-metre volcano in Bali. And I thought, they can't still be there. They can't still be there. But eventually, their friends, who this girl had managed to contact, managed to get hold of me. I spoke to the Foreign Office. We sent them, you know, the tracking things that we had and the various messages and so on and so forth. And the search parties went out up the mountain and found them. But it was tech that was able to sort of narrow down where they had been. So they were very, very silly. They relied on tech when they really, really shouldn't have done, but tech saved them as well.
So very interesting. So simultaneously, technology was a kind of salvation, but also a kind of root of the problem as well.
Yeah. Well, at the root of the problem is they're very, very stupid, in my opinion. But Bear Grylls, they grew up going to scouts and sort of watching Bear Grylls survival videos and all the rest of it. And they did sort of remember that, having not been prepared, which is the number one rule, some of the tips that they had learnt in terms of sort of making a shelter, trying to find water and so on and so forth. But after they were rescued, Bear Grylls got wind of it and basically said, you just must never rely on tech.
Yeah.
You must always, sure, have the tech, but also have a compass, have a map, tell people where you're going, when you will be back. So tech is fabulous, but you can't rely on it, yeah.
Ros, I'm interested to know your wife's thoughts on this matter. Perhaps you could let us know her thinking. Did she think that the police's response was overblown, or was she grateful that they were being quite proactive and using the resources that they had to try and find you?
Well, I think she was very grateful that they did take it seriously, but she was also taken aback by the sort of level of detail which they wanted to go into. Because I suppose, you know, ultimately, you know, the first thing you wanted to know was if I had any identification marks. It's already sort of jumping ahead to identifying my body and so on. But, I mean, I never used to tell my wife where I was going. On that day I had done, you know, in latter years I've sort of given her more greater idea of the route I'm going to take. But you can't always stick to a route. You know, sometimes you might plan out a route, but when you get there, a river is in spate or something, and you have to change your plans. So, you know, there's no sort of foolproof way.
And Catherine, when the search began properly for your sons, and the search parties went out, how long did that take for them to be found after the parties had set out?
A good few hours. I found out they were missing 40 hours in total, and I realised they were missing about 7 o'clock on the day that people were voting in the general election. And there were search teams out there pretty quickly, and they were found about, I only had about 7 hours of having a total nervous breakdown.
Only 7 hours.
Oh, yeah. Only 7 hours. But given that they'd been gone for 40 hours, it could have been. Yeah, could have been a lot worse.
Yes. And I suppose, perhaps most importantly, would you ever let your sons go travelling alone again?
Well, they're technically grown up, so they're beyond my control. But I was very, very, very cross. And particularly because last summer we did have the tragedies of Michael Mosley and Jay Slater. Mm-hmm. And on the Monday, they had rung me. And I had been on the election trail with the then Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. We'd been doing a gin tasting thing. It wasn't all as fun as that, but that was a particularly fun thing. And I was a bit sort of, didn't have time to chat, but my final words to them were, because they'd said something about a hike and I wasn't paying attention, and I just said, you know, don't go off on your own. Mm. And Matthew said to me, well, we're not stupid, Mum.
Well, Catherine and Ross, thank you for joining.
And finally, Madeline Grant, the Telegraph's assistant comment editor and parliamentary sketch writer, writes in this week's magazine about the news that Amazon have paid more than $1 billion to take full creative control of the James Bond franchise. She argues that in recent years, Bond has lost the charm, wit and romp of the original Connery and Moore eras, and it's been replaced by a grittier, more vengeful Bond with bloated plot lines and annoyingly self-referential tone. Well, what can be done to turn it all around? With the author, William Boyd, who has written his own James Bond story, joined me to discuss. I started by asking William whether he agrees that Bond needs saving.
I think it's too late. The Bond movie franchise has morphed into something totally alien from the Bond novels that Ian Fleming wrote. And they're now a force of their own. They're sort of generic, preposterous action movies. And so I think there's no way we can go back to, for example, my favorite Bond movie is From Russia with Love, which is 1963, the second Bond film. But it seems like an Oscar-winning work of art in comparison to the latest iteration. So no, I think it's just part of the IP franchise issue that some organization like Amazon will pay this sum of money for to get their hands on the Bond franchise and will do with it what they want. I mean, you know, wait for the aftershave and the dinner jacket and the let alone the theme park. So it's I think it's too late. We can't, you know, rewind to those old Bond movies, let alone the world of Fleming's novels, which is even more ancient. It's 1950s. So it's long gone, I'm afraid.
William, you did, of course, write your own version of a Bond novel. Can you talk us through that process and the sort of concerns that fed into that? Did you feel like you needed to save James Bond?
Well, it wasn't so much that. It was because I'd written so much about Ian Fleming as a strange individual. I'd even put him as a character in my novel, Any Human Heart. And I suspect that might be why I was approached by the Fleming family to write this continuation novel. And also I had this curious connection with three of the James Bond actors who I'd also worked with on films that I'd written or directed. So it seemed almost inevitable.
Which three, may I ask?
Sean Connery, Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig. I wrote films that Sean Connery and Pierce Brosnan were in, and I've written two films that I actually directed Daniel Craig in a film that I wrote called The Trench. And then he was in an Evelyn Waugh adaptation that I wrote. But so I got to know them all. So there's this very curious fatalistic moment when the Fleming family said, would you like to write a continuation novel? And I said yes instantly, because the great thing about that offer is it comes with total freedom. You just have to respect the brand, as it were, but you can do anything you want with it within those, you know, perfectly understandable limits. And so it was here you're given a mythic cultural literary figure and said, you know, have fun with him. So I did. I took it very seriously, but I really enjoyed the process. And my Bond novel, Solo, sits on the shelf with my other novels as well. It's in no sense just a job of work. I really gave it my all, and I think tried to present a well-rounded three-dimensional portrait of Bond that was entirely sourced in Fleming's novels. And so I think if anybody doesn't know what the literary Bond is like, they could read Solo and get a very, you know, good portrait of him.
Well, so the literary Bond is obviously one thing. When it comes to the film versions of Bond and those adaptations, you said before that you thought that the Bond films had kind of passed a point of no return. They're a bit unsalvageable. What do you make of the suggestion, and some people have been saying this, what do you make of the suggestion that Amazon should do a period film? They should almost go back in time. They should set it in the 1960s with all the kind of trappings of that era. And that is the only way to really recapture some sense of the Fleming Bond or the Sean Connery era of the films. What would you make of that as an idea?
I think that would be a brilliant idea, but I'm sure they'll never do it, because even the first Bond film, Dr. No, was out of date. Since then, all the Bond films have been set in the year they were made. And so they become increasingly further and further away from the world of Ian Fleming. And when they ran out of Fleming novels and started, you know, kind of creating their own, you know, Bond narratives, they became ever more distant from the original. And so they lost all touch with Fleming's creation, became something sui generis. You know, it was they are, as I say, preposterous, expensive action movies now. They're not, they've got nothing, very little to do with, apart from the name of the central character, with the novels that Fleming wrote.
William, could I ask you what you think makes a good Bond villain? One of the points that Madeline says is that the films have rather moved away from tracing actual geopolitics, and they don't really want to go there when it comes to picking certain countries to be villainous. What do you think makes a good Bond villain?
Well, I had to create one myself in my own novel, and I created a particularly nasty South African mercenary called Cobus Breed. So I think they have to be, you know, sort of idiosyncratic and also thoroughly unpleasant. And my novel was much more, as the word is now, granular. There were no gadgets. There was no sort of overriding sort of superpower attempt to dominate the world. It was just Bond up against this spectacularly unpleasant, ruthless killer. So I think those are the two criteria, that they have to be idiosyncratic and memorable, and then they should be extremely evil. And then the kind of formula works. And, you know, my villain is exactly that. He has a scar on his face that makes one of his eyes constantly weep. And see that in a film, but it's set in 1969, my novel, so it's a retro Bond, and they'll never go back. But I think it's a big mistake, because analog spying is so much more interesting than digital spying, and I think that, well, maybe Amazon will go back, and I would applaud that, because that's the world of Fleming novels, and that's the basic inspiration for the whole franchise.
My final question then, William, I suppose, is if the franchise has gone so far off the rails, when do you think's the last point when it basically worked? When's the last Bond film that you think that was at least true to the spirit of Fleming to some extent?
Well, I think in a way it's the Sean Connery films, and maybe it's Thunderball was the last one, because Connery was very odd casting, but is very true to the Bond that Fleming described in his novels. And I think once we got into Roger Moore territory, it all got a bit silly and camp, whereas the Connery films are, I think, genuine reflections of the novels they're based on. And so that's, for me, when the cutoff point is. I never really liked the Roger Moore ones, and he wasn't like the Bond that Fleming created. But, you know, Bond is half Scottish, half Swiss. He's got no English blood in him at all. And so, you know, Sir Sean was perfect casting. And actually, he looked like the Bond that Fleming described. He always said Bond looked like the American singer Hoagie Carmichael, who everyone has forgotten today. But Sean Connery bears a resemblance to Hoagie Carmichael. So, and Fleming, who was resistant to Connery initially, then saw that actually he had found his perfect Bond. So for me, the cutoff point is the last Sean Connery Bond film, and then it all becomes a bit silly and frivolous.
William, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
And that's everything this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed what we've talked about, you can pick up a copy of the magazine and you can read all the articles in full. And if you like this podcast, please do click the follow button. You'll then be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we hope you'll join us again next week.